Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information, security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, as usual, we'll be walking through all the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And we'll have a special guest joining us for the back part of the news, Shubham Shah, Asset Notes CTO. He'll be joining us to talk about his team's discovery and disclosure of a remote code execution flaw in the Zoom video conferencing software. They found that flaw back in March. That's kind of, I kind of knew about it because they're friends of mine and I work with them. But yeah, we'll be dishing the bug details on this week's show now that it's safe to do so. This week's sponsor interview is great. It's just, it really is great. This week's sponsor is Casada, which is an Australian company, a startup that runs a bot filtering service. It's a cloud service. Casada is a relatively new company, but they're kicking some pretty serious goals here in Australia, and they've raised some money and they're pushing into other markets at the moment, like the United States. But instead of supplying us with one of their people, they suggested that for this segment, we interview one of their customers, which is REA Group, and their CISO and head of platform, Craig Templeton. REA Group runs realestate.com.au, which is, as far as I know, Australia's biggest real estate listings website. And they had all sorts of trouble with content scrapers, service interruptions caused by bad bots, cred stuffing, you name it. And in the end, they went with Casada to solve their bot problems. And Craig pops by this week to talk about all the issues they were having prior to using Casada, and also to sing Casada's praises. Now, getting a reference customer to speak publicly is a Herculean task, so full credit to Casada for making this one happen. And if you operate a website that operates at scale, that pushes a lot of traffic, you will probably want to hear that one. But right now, it's time to dive into this week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, a group of US mayors has got together in the United States and sort of passed a resolution saying that they're no longer going to pay for ransomware. It'll be interesting to see which of the mayors actually stick to that resolution when they're the ones getting ransomware, though.
Yes, that's, I guess, the proof's in the pudding on this one. This is apparently the like conference of mayors, and they were getting together, and yes, they made this resolution that they think that being ransomware is bad and that paying the ransom operators encourages it, and maybe that they shouldn't pay out. Of course, we've seen a whole bunch of US, you know, municipalities and, you know, small, you know, local governments get affected by ransomware. So, I mean, this does kind of, I suppose, suggest that maybe they would like to get targeted less and they try to send a message. We'll see whether it works.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder, look, I know, you know, local governments do operate some critical infrastructure, but I wonder just as organizations, whether or not you could really consider them to be critical infrastructure in and of themselves, right? And at what point some of the better equipped agencies in the US might be able to go after some of these ransomware crews, because they're causing all sorts of drama.
Yeah, they certainly are. And I think, you know, now that the operators of the ransomware operations have kind of seen that it is effective, you know, that you can get real money out of local governments, you would expect this to spread beyond the US. I mean, there's plenty of similar sorts of organizations with all of the same root cause problems, you know, of small scale and not enough focus on technology and, you know, it's just not being core business for them. And yeah, not being critical infrastructure, not being supported in the way that central infrastructure might be. Yeah, you would expect to see this replicated elsewhere and, you know, beyond a few US mayoralties.
One of the institutions targeted this week was New York City's Monroe College. The attackers are demanding $2 million in Bitcoin, 170 Bitcoins to sort of turn everything back on. It really does feel like this round of ransomware that we're dealing with in 2019 is different in nature to the spike that we experienced a few years ago, in that they tend to really get into an environment and cause a lot more havoc rather than affecting a few key systems.
Yeah, I mean, in the previous ones we've seen also, there was kind of focus on retail ransomware, you know, individual end users who have limited ability to pay and kind of limited amounts of data, whereas, you know, focusing on organizations that, you know, probably easier to compromise, frankly, these days, you know, if people are using, you know, modern cloud stuff and modern OSs, you know, they're a harder target, perhaps, you know, than a school or a local government. So, yeah, it definitely has kind of changed the relationship between the scammers and their targets, I think.
Yeah, a Japan-based cryptocurrency exchange, Bitpoint. I mean, look, cryptocurrency exchanges get knocked over all the time, right? So we barely even mention it in the news. But these guys lost $32 million. So I think that rates a mention.
It's probably worth, you know, 30 seconds of airtime. Yeah, they apparently got in, cleaned out both hot and the cold wallets, which does suggest that the cold wallet wasn't actually that cold. And yeah, they managed to, the people who run the exchange spotted it, shut it down pretty quickly, but not until, yeah, 30-something million US dollars worth of rubbish crypto gone into the ether.
Tepid wallets, perhaps.
Tepid wallets, yes, exactly.
It's a technical term. It's a technical term. We have seen Gamma Group's FinSpy spyware popping up again all over the place, most notably, in my mind, in Myanmar, a wonderful bastion of respect for human rights that country is. But I think it's Kaspersky that's pushed a report on the latest FinSpy stuff. But yeah, they're back. They certainly didn't die after getting owned by Phineas Fisher all those years ago.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, this kind of compromise applies evolutionary pressure to these organizations, you know, because there's still demand for their products, there's to be still people willing to pay good money for them. And yeah, of course, they're going to go out and look at what they've lost and figure out a better way of doing it. And yeah, we are seeing lots of reports, you know, fairly regular reports of this being used in a number of places around the world, and the AB companies, you know, are kind of keeping an eye on it. But, you know, sort of public perception of this kind of software has changed, I think, a bit after the Khashoggi situation, and, you know, whether or not we're willing to put up with it. On a commercial scale, I don't know yet.
Staying with mobile malware, I think last week we spoke about a report where people crossing into the Xinjiang province in China were having, you know, malware installed on their Android mobile devices. Vice is reporting that Chinese antivirus companies don't flag that malware, which is, I guess, really not surprising at all.
Yeah, that seems like per expectations. The malware in question appears to have turned up on VirusTotal. We saw a bunch of the Western AV companies start flagging it as, you know, kind of as malware or malicious stuff. Chinese companies, yeah, not so much.
Yeah. Now, look, you just mentioned VirusTotal. Shannon Vavra over at Cyberscoop, who's been writing some really good stuff lately, she's written a feature here about, you know, how Cyber Command is kind of using VT and how it's pushing more and more stuff public and kind of what the objectives are there and, you know, what its wins look like. It's kind of just an interesting overview, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think it follows on from the conversation that we had, you know, last week or the week before about kind of the way this is becoming a much more mainstream part of geopolitics. And here we are seeing, you know, Cyber Command and DHS, you know, specifically kind of publishing details about Iranian operations in this case, you know, the example they talk through in this article, you know, through VirusTotal and pushing it more rapidly into the private sector. And we have seen some tension between, you know, Cyber Command and DHS's role in kind of these in communicating information about state actors. And Cyber Command really has been pushing forward and, you know, getting the stuff onto VirusTotal where it's picked up by all sorts of different teams. And that's kind of changing the dynamic a bit. And that's kind of the thrust of this report, that it does change the area in which other countries, you know, intelligence and, you know, kind of government affiliated actors have to operate, because it's, you know, they've got a much more chance of getting burnt much more rapidly. And when something posts on VirusTotal, right, they can expect a much more rapid and diverse set of responses than when it's just, you know, Cyber Command or just, you know, kind of governments acting against them rather than the entire private sector as well.
They're kind of operating a bit like a CERT when you think about it, right? Like, but they're taking stuff that previously just would have remained classified and doing CERT-like things with it.
I mean, certainly if you look at some of the reporting we used to get, you know, I'm thinking the stuff you get from DHS and FBI, I mean, and what I see of it, which, I mean, obviously I'm not the really target audience for a lot of this information, but, you know, from what I see, it tends to not be super actionable, I mean, in terms of being timely mostly. Whereas, you know, shoving it straight up on VT lets it hook into all sorts of automated systems as well. And I think, you know, that does materially change things and probably for the better, but it is just a weird kind of dynamic seeing, you know, stuff coming out of where it would have been, you know, traditionally pretty closed information, now just be out there for everybody to use.
Now, look, we've got another Shannon Vavra piece here from Cyberscoop, really looking at, you know how the authorization process for Cyber Command to do stuff was changed about a year ago to make it easier for them to sort of just act, right? And now Congress is kind of getting a little bit twitchy because they still don't know what those new rules look like. It's sort of been held from Congress, and they're kind of worried that maybe Cyber Command could wind up escalating a conflict via its actions. And there's a bit of a push now to get those operational rules into the hands of lawmakers so that they can actually know what they are, which seems reasonable to me.
Yeah, like this does seem like correctly functioning oversight. Like you would imagine they would have some interest, you know, being another branch of American government that, you know, ought to be having some understanding of what's being done in their name. And of course, you know, we have seen Cyber Command, you know, changing the dynamic a bit. The previous story is a perfect example of that. And yeah, the chance of that results in escalation, the chance of that results in changing of some of the dynamics, you know, with other countries. Yeah, that seems like a thing Congress would be interested in.
Yeah, so who knows? We could see a very boring document come out of that, which is yes, what I suspect it is. Krebs is reporting that political campaigns in the United States can actually use discounted cybersecurity services. That's according to the Federal Election Commission over there in the States. This is interesting because we spoke about this a little while ago. There was a problem where, you know, people wanted to offer like discounted or free services to political campaigns. That was kind of problematic, because it was kind of a campaign donation type of thing. But there's been some clarification now, and by and large, it's good news.
Yeah, it seems that, yeah, if you're a security company or firm that wants to offer support to political organizations at a discounted or free rate, you can do so. But you have to also be offering that same service to other nonprofits or similar organizations that are non-political so that it's part of your normal business and therefore it's not a special case for a political campaign, which seems, I guess on one hand, it seems like it would make sense. On the other hand, you know, the focus of this is, of course, the political organizations. Like they're the ones that need it more than perhaps, you know, nonprofits operating in other fields. So
I get that, but see, to me, I'm just thinking this is great for small nonprofits, right? Because they're going to get deluged with free stuff,
right?
so that then they can give that same free stuff over to political campaigns. So to me, that seems like a good move. Now, this is truly a 2019 type of story where Facebook has been fined $5 billion by the FTC in the United States to the rapturous applause of all of Facebook's shareholders. The price went up, you know. They're thrilled, right? Because it's only $5 billion and it's not really clear if there are any sort of, you know, binding undertakings that Facebook will have to adhere to, you know, based on this settlement. Now we've got this situation where senators are sort of giving the FTC a hard time, saying it wasn't enough. You're going soft on Facebook. I would also note that Facebook is facing a lot of resistance to its proposed Libra cryptocurrency idea. And I get the feeling partially that's a bit of blowback for its other snafus. But yeah, $5 billion fine and all the political shenanigans that have resulted from it, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, $5 billion certainly does look like a lot of money. I mean, you know, I'd like $5 billion.
I'd also like $5 billion.
Yeah. But of course, this is mostly around the Cambridge Analytica and kind of the way that they were sharing data from friends' networks, so, you know, far beyond what anyone kind of really anticipated. And, you know, for the scale of data that resulted in getting exposed, you know, $5 billion is not actually, you know, super unreasonable. And yeah, some of the arguments about why it should be more and what other things they ought to be lumped with, you know, do also seem pretty reasonable. But I think, you know, in the end, the point that you made, the fact that the share price goes up kind of indicates that it wasn't really enough to change behavior.
No, I mean, I think Facebook can find $5 billion in its spare pants, you know?
Well, especially if they start a cryptocurrency, right?
Oh, God, I've avoided talking about that one on the show, but we will eventually inevitably have to cover it when it gets inexorably closer to being a real thing. What on earth, or I'm sorry, what in space is going on with the Galileo satellites, Adam?
Yeah, the European Space Consortium that runs the Galileo satellite navigation system, which is not completely in a production state yet. It's still in like an earlier pilot where they've got the satellites on orbit and it is providing some service, but it's not in its full production configuration. It's been down for something like 3 or 4 days now where there are still signals from the satellites, but the accuracy of the navigation and timing data is so degraded that users are being advised not to rely on it at all. There's no real strong information about exactly what's happened, but the scuttlebutt seems to be it's something to do with the ground station that provides the high quality timing data. They have a bunch of cesium clocks and some meson clocks. I don't know how a meson clock works, but anyway.
I don't know how a cesium clock works either.
I got a better idea about a cesium clock than a meson clock. But anyway, it sounds like perhaps the meson clock stopped working and the backup one doesn't, well, I don't know, whatever. There's something wrong with the timing source. And of course, those navigation systems rely completely on very accurate clock information for their data. So, yeah, I guess we're kind of lucky that it's not in production and we're lucky that there are other options for satellite navigation networks. Can you imagine if that happened with GPS? Well, like we would be in just a world of fail.
Yeah. So is Galileo a sort of a different type of – does it use a different type of protocol than GPS?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same logical system, right? It's a satellite navigation system based on timing, blah, blah, blah. But it is, you know, separate frequencies, separate protocols.
Okay.
A lot of receivers integrate all three, you know, the Russian one, the US GPS and the Galileo, so that you've got some redundancy or you can switch depending on which is better in your territory. But yeah, the Europeans obviously wanted to be independent from the Americans and obviously not use the Russian GLONASS system.
It's funny that you mentioned the Russian one because TASS, the Russian news agency, when I was doing a bit of research on this, they'd published a real gloaty post saying, you know, we're not affected by anything like this because we build defenses against this sort of thing. And I'm like, wow, way to be you know, just poking them in the eye, them in the eye. Now, look, you suggested this one for this week's news, which is a tool for capturing traffic from Qualcomm-based phones like over the air. I didn't get a chance to read this one, Adam, because I figured, you know, you've read it because you're the one who submitted it. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is a blog post from the group over at P1Sec in Paris, who do a lot of work around mobile network systems. This is a blog post kind of talking through a tool they developed, which uses a debug interface on a bunch of the Qualcomm baseband chips that's common on Android phones and like USB cell modems, where you can get an over-the-air capture out of the debug interface and kind of reconstitute a packet capture from the radio side of the modem. This doesn't let you necessarily sniff the entire band like a software of my radio would, but it lets you see what the baseband is processing off the air and see a bunch of the control information. And if you're doing mobile hacking, that kind of thing is just super useful. Being able to see what your radios are doing, what normal operation of a legitimate, you know, phone looks like, so that you can make your, you know, open source tools, you know, rubbish tools actually work like they're supposed to. It's just super useful. The blog post is also one of the best kind of, you know, introductory write-ups to how modern mobile networks work that you're going to read anywhere. Kind of compares and contrasts between 2G, 3G, 4G, explains how it all works in relatively straightforward language. It's just a really solid write-up on cell tech and totally worth reading, you know, whether or not you use the tool.
Link is in this week's show notes. You can grab the tool. You can read the blog post. Interesting reporting from Motherboard here, where they essentially FOI'd a Palantir manual for the police who are supposed to be using their system. They kind of overcooked the headline here saying, this is Palantir's top secret user manual for cops. Like, top secret? I don't think that's how that works. And if you can FOI it, it's... anyway, whatever. It's a good piece, right? And it really does a good job of showing how you can pull together records and very quickly be able to build a system like this where you can enter someone's name and then bang, you just got all sorts of data about them. One thing they focus on here is the way the California police are using automated license plate readers to essentially give an operator an idea of like everywhere you've been. Because every time you drive past a cop car, that winds up in a database that eventually winds up being accessed by their Palantir installation. It's a great write-up. What did you think of it?
Yeah, it's a good write-up. The top secret, but of course you point out, is a bit silly when, you know, many of the things that they've used in the article, like the screenshots and stuff, are, you know, like how to click on the search box and like type in a name sort of thing. Like, so not super sophisticated docs there, but what it does do is kind of give the reader a really good understanding of kind of how they're using it, what they're using it for, and the value of that kind of, you know, data fusion stuff. Like, we're pulling together data from a whole bunch of different data sets and they're making it queryable, you know, in a really straightforward way that the average police officer who's investigating some crime can use. I was a little torn because, you know, on the one hand, it is a bit breathy about, you know, the surveillance aspects and the intrusiveness of it. And, you know, there is very legitimate things to say there. On the other hand, how many times on the show have we argued against key escrow or the kind of intrusive, you know, breaking crypto in the mobile network or forcing carriers to back to their phones or whatever? You know, we've argued against that because, well, you know, in the end, gumshoe police work is what really matters, and that's what the police should be doing. And this seems like a good example of that's what police work looks like, right? You pull a whole bunch of threads, and the fact that the data is more easily available than it might have once been.
Oh, that changes like that changes the dynamic significantly enough for me to think that
the ANPR stuff, like the number plate recognition, does. Right. I mean, having those logs before the fact, right, rather than after you've got a warrant and then you've tailed someone. That, I mean, that does change it. But
hey, you know, on the other hand, even collect the info, but maybe require a warrant to access it. You know, which is kind of how it works in SIGINT. I just think if you're going to have this information, put some controls on it, for God's sakes. Like the idea that you can just plug in a name and get a really detailed picture of areas where people visit, like that just feels wrong to me.
Yeah, and I think the oversight and the warranting and the way that this is audited obviously is the kind of the most important thing, because this data is going to accumulate. People are going to bolt search interfaces onto it, of course. But yeah, we need to make sure that it is at least used in a manner that's controlled. And we do see reports of people being disciplined for misuse of searching. We've seen a couple of instances with the New Zealand police, where people have looked up the ex-partner's information or something in the some of the databases. So we do see some level of audit and oversight. But obviously, yeah, it needs to be reflective of the kinds of data that are being collected, which is a lot more than it used to be.
Well, one thing I'll just say is, like, it's license plates now, but it'll be your face in a few years.
Yes, yeah, of course.
Right. Every time you drive past or walk past a cop car, in China, they got those sort of surveillance posts popping up everywhere, which do track people via facial rec. And also, they capture broadcasts from your mobile devices and things like that. Like, we've got to start thinking about this stuff now. And I think it's not necessarily just what this story outlines in terms of what they're doing now, but you start thinking about some of the future use cases here, and it does get a little bit freaky, I think. And you're right, these data stores exist, but once you start making them indexable and cross, you can cross-reference them, you got problems.
Yeah, and I think whatever problems you have, Palantir is going to be out there at the front, making them worse, right?
Yeah, or making them work, depending on your depending point of view,
on your perspective. Yes.
Now, speaking of surveillance reports, some interesting reporting from CNN here. They got their hands on hundreds of surveillance reports compiled for the Ecuadorian government by UC Global, a private Spanish security company. And these reports detail sort of the movements of Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in 2016, and also visitors. And, you read through this, and I don't think it's the best constructed piece, just as a piece of writing, but I think there's enough in there to make it really interesting, because there was some shady stuff happening in 2016 at the Ecuadorian embassy.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the outset, right, the fact that the Ecuadorians have private security monitoring their own embassy, and then that's been leaked or disclosed to the media by whatever mechanism, like, that in itself is deliciously ironic. But yeah, some of the meetings and some of the comings and goings, certainly do sound pretty shady. I mean, there's a couple of screen caps from some surveillance video in the story, with kind of like dudes in full camo and balaclavas showing up, at the front door of the embassy with packages for Julian and stuff. It's all a bit strange. And yeah, there's some good kind of bits of timeline, talking through, where various key aspects of the DNC hack kind of happened over time, and then what was going on in the embassy and with Julian at the time. So it certainly is an interesting piece. It is a bit jumbled. It's a bit kind of hard to make.
That's what I mean. It's hard to follow, isn't it? Right. And they refer to meeting with key hackers, and they're like CCC people. And you're like, okay, that doesn't really mean what you think it means. And they've sort of conflated a few things together, but there's enough in here. If you read it carefully, you're like, wow, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine the people who are really digging into this kind of stuff will have a field day with some of these things. We may see some of the more, the raw data show up elsewhere, because, yeah, Lord knows what other interesting nuggets are in there. It's almost like we need some kind of website which could, collect this information and then publish it.
Yeah, unfiltered, right? It would be amazing. They might want to leak it, put it in some sort of wiki. I don't know. This one is gold. So now, good. This is, we often talk about business email compromise. This is, I guess, a variation, and very, very funny. Please walk us through this story, Adam.
So the story starts much like you'd expect, right? You come up with a fake purchase order, you send it to the purchasing department or whatever, and you walk off with a few million dollars worth of stuff that you didn't pay for, right? Standard business email compromise, kind of, invoice fraud, whatever else.
So boring, far, so normal, as you would say.
Exactly. Like, why we wouldn't even bother putting that in the news list, right? Except that the people in question were impersonating the US Navy to some defense contractor. And the things they put on their fake purchase order were like super confidential classified military gear that they got delivered to a fake Navy base, which just was like some, you know, kind of commercial office building somewhere in the US. And yeah, they made off with secret stuff worth millions.
Yeah, they got like, they snagged themselves like $10 million worth of gear, but $3.2 million of that was classified gear that they shouldn't have even known existed.
The reporting says that even pictures of the equipment in question is considered controlled. So,
yeah,
someone is going to be getting, you know, a bit of a spanking over that one, I am sure.
You would think, but you got to wonder too. I mean, is this fraud or is this nation state? Like, well, exactly, it appears right? That it's actually like fraud, right? Like, it's people out for a buck, not trying to sell it to foreign powers.
Yeah, because according to the reporting, the people in question had some of the money that they had made was like $6 million worth of televisions, like LG TVs, and $1 million worth of iPads and stuff. And then, yeah, just $3 million of classified military comms gear, you know. Shove it in the warehouse, flog it on eBay.
That's it. Sell it out of a car boot out the back of the pub, you know. Can I interest you in a, yeah. Now, there's some crew targeting home routers in Brazil, and they've knocked over about 180,000 home routers, which is quite a few. And they're just doing typical sort of, I think they're doing cross-site request forgery to change the DNS settings in those routers for later use. This isn't something particularly new. We've seen these types of campaigns in the past. What is interesting here is NCSC out of the UK has issued an alert on this one.
Yeah, I mean, we have seen this kind of thing mostly used for pushing advertising networks, you know, up the DNS settings in the router, and then hijack DNS and serve ads or whatever other things. Yeah, it does seem that the scale of this particular crew has been kind of picking up as to why NCSC picked, you know, this particular thing. I mean, because we saw, you know, quarter of a million Microtech devices in Brazil, you know, get compromised by another crew last year. So, I mean, certainly this kind of home router compromise is being done in all sorts of places. But yeah, maybe there's some more focus on DNS lately, I'm not sure.
Yeah, now the original Magecart crew have been knocking over S3 buckets and having a great time.
Yeah, apparently someone, either the original Magecart crew or someone using similar tooling, I guess, has been just kind of brute forcing through S3 buckets, finding ones which are writable, looking through them for JavaScript files, and then just straight up tacking their Magecart, you know, card skimming JavaScript onto the end of every JavaScript file they can find.
And then just waiting to see if it pops up in production and calls back.
Just hoping it gets executed somewhere, which, you know, it's one of those things that's super dumb, but probably totally works.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't have to do it, you know, you don't have to steal a lot of credit cards to make a reasonable amount of money for, you know, how much it costs you to do it. So yeah, seems innovative.
Bad news this week for 5 in 7 Bulgarians, Adam.
Yeesh, yeah. Somebody apparently owned the country's national revenue agency as part of the finance ministry there, and nicked off with a whole bunch of data for something like, yeah, 5 million Bulgarians out of the, what, 7 million that there are. And then a bunch of this has now subsequently been leaked through the media. The hacker who did this said he's been in that environment for something like 11 years. So, you know, Lord knows what's been done and how many other people are up in there as well. But yeah, what this means for identity theft or what, you know, who else has the data in Bulgaria, we don't really know. You know, it's just bad.
Sea Turtle, a group that has been linked to Iran, are still going buck wild with their whole DNS hijacking stuff.
Yeah, this was the crew that compromised NetNod out of Sweden a while ago to get into DNS root-level domains in a bunch of places. Same crew has been back and is now up in the organization that runs the top-level registry for Greece, .gr and .el. We don't really know what they've been doing in there, yeah.
Oh, they weren't doing anything, I'm sure.
just kicking around, you know.
Just hanging out, you know, yeah. Hanging out on their shelves. EFF is suing AT&T. Apparently, they've launched a class action against AT&T, I should say, for selling location information to bounty hunters. You know, these were the stories that Joe Cox did a really good job with at Motherboard. He was exposing a lot of that. There was one that we didn't talk about the other week where some of that data wound up being used by some bounty hunters to trace a guy to a car dealership, and there was a shootout and both the bounty hunters and the suspect were killed. There was even video of it, which I watched. It was hardcore stuff, right? But now we're seeing some lawsuits. It's you would hope that between the reporting and the lawsuits that this stuff is going to go away in terms of them just on selling that data, right?
Yeah, I mean, you would certainly hope that the message has been pretty clearly received, that this is just not a thing you should do if you don't want to get class actioned. You know, we last time we talked about it, I think I said, you know, it's inevitable that we're going to see this. And, of course, the EFF is a natural place for this to land. Whether it succeeds, of course, we'll wait and see. But, I mean, they're going after AT&T, whose privacy policy said, quote, "We will not sell your personal information to anyone for any purpose, period," end quote. Which, you know, you can kind of see why that might...
Where you are 24/7 might actually constitute private information.
Maybe just a little.
Staying with US telcos and Sprint, this is an interesting one, right? Because it's kind of light on detail, but they're saying that attackers unknown breached customer accounts via a Samsung website. Like, so how does that work? Was it customers using Samsung phones, or was it some sort of weird access arrangement between Samsung and Sprint, which coughed up data on all of their subscribers? Like, what do we know here?
So, yeah, we don't know a whole bunch. Samsung were operating some kind of website. It's described as the Add-A-Line website. So I'm assuming you have some kind of mobile account with Sprint and then with a Samsung phone, and then there's some way you can, like, bodge on an extra VoIP service. I don't know, whatever any of it is. It has some way to query account data for Sprint, and it exposed, you know, a bunch of information, you know, account data, account holder details, you know, various billing address, that kind of thing. Presumably there was some kind of regular, you know, kind of direct object reference or whatever bug in the site, and someone nicked off with a whole bunch of subscriber data through that. That's kind of my guess from reading what is a pretty, you know, kind of, you know, muddy set of reporting. You know, either way, we don't know how long, we don't know how many customers, we don't know, you know, very much at all. If you're a Sprint customer, maybe you should ask them.
Let's talk about Agent Smith, which is a great name. I don't normally know, you know, I don't like bug names. Malware's different, right? And Agent Smith is a great name for this malware. It's done pretty well, infecting around 25 million devices. Thankfully, I think it's just serving ads at the moment, but it is kind of interesting how it works.
Yeah, so this is a piece of mobile malware, which once it gets on your phone through the usual kind of, you know, like fake apps on rubbish app stores kind of thing, escalates privilege on your Android phone and then will go around and like replace other applications with Trojan versions of them. So you've got like WhatsApp or whatever installed on your phone. It'll actually replace that with a one that's got itself hooked into it, like the Agent Smith malware hooked into it, and then prevent future updates so that it doesn't get removed, which is quite a sort of insidious way to make sure it stays resident on your device for quite a long period of time. The other reporting we've seen about this is that this is starting to crop up in the mainline Google Play Store, like not just in the rubbish third-party app stores. So yeah, maybe a thing that people do need to look out for.
Well, how do you look out for that?
Well, I mean, by not using the rubbish Android ecosystem, I guess would be my first suggestion. But I don't know if I can offer anything more practical than that. I mean, Android McAfee, that's what you need.
I mean, look, I haven't been into the Play Store in a while, but I remember the last time I went in there, it was only like 1 or 2 years ago. I was trying to set up an app for someone, and I think I searched for Messenger. It was like Facebook Messenger. And the number one thing that popped up under a search for Messenger was not Facebook Messenger. Like this stuff is not that easy to avoid. This next one, we've got to talk about it, but I got to mention first that Martin Groten actually had a great tweet about this story, which is, you don't even need to read the paper to know that research by academics stealing data from air-gapped systems via a keyboard's LEDs, you just know that research came out of the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel, right? Because that's where all this research appears to come out of. But yeah, more of their golden hits, I guess.
They just love side channels so much down there. And I've seen a few of that research team. I think they did talk last Black Hat when we were there.
Yeah.
Like it's really solid research. I mean, it's kind of stunt, but it is really, I mean, that doesn't take away from the technical level of sophistication of some of the radio stuff they've done. Anyway, in this case, they are doing a slightly more obvious thing, which is exfiltrating data using the keyboard lights. We've seen them previously exfil data via the lights on like the routers and stuff and the network interfaces by blinking those. But yeah, basically the same thing. Optical side channel via the lights, pick up the signal from a security camera or other device that can see those lights, exfil the data like that. You know, it's good stunt hacking.
It certainly is. McAfee having a bad week. Well, I should say McAfee customers having a bad week. This is like, it's rare these days, isn't it, to see one quite this bad, but this is a shocker.
Yeah, McAfee shipped like a signature update or definitions update for their endpoint security product, which apparently stopped you from logging in, which, you know, I guess is improve the security of the endpoint, so that's nice.
that's up there with Sophos a few years ago, like flagging core Windows DLLs as malicious. System DLL,
So not so great. There's been a few people affected by this, apparently, and then the process of backing it out is like, you have to boot in safe mode and delete a registry key. It's not simple, right?
Like,
it's not good.
Google is removing its built-in cross-site scripting protection, XSS Auditor, which has been in the browser since 2010. And apparently they're removing it just because it's got too easy to bypass, and they're, patching the bypasses has just got real clunky, and they're just like, that's it, they're killing it.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, the nature of cross-site scripting has changed a bit in terms of where it's happening and the kinds of things you could rely on to prevent it. And XSS Auditor was introduced, as you said, a long time ago. It's just kind of not that relevant anymore. We've got a bunch more effective controls for handling cross-site scripting. And of course, it was also the only browser that really had a mechanism like this. I mean, the IE1, no one really cares about it anymore. So yeah, I think you can certainly see the motivation of just kind of letting it fall by the wayside and be replaced by a bunch more modern tricks. I mean, content security policy obviously is one, and we've seen Google talk about another approach they're coming up with to deal with DOM-based cross-site scripting and stuff. So yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to miss this too much. Certainly, at worst, it costs a security researcher an extra kind of half a day of fiddling to make their proof of concept work. Sometimes much less if you talk to people who are real gung ho at bypassing it.
Microsoft has just released a public preview of its Azure AD FIDO 2 passwordless sign-in, which is pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, we've seen Microsoft doing a lot of work in, thinking about how authentication should work in Azure. And we've seen a lot of people moving their Active Directories towards Azure, which by and large has been a real improvement. But the uptake of multi-factor auth has never been what they want, and offering a bunch more different ways of doing multi-factor authentication, both with tokens and integrating with some of the biometric options that are available on modern Windows, makes a lot of sense. I mean, the big thing, I guess, about adding FIDO style support to this is that it's going to be better cross-platform. We're going to see more support on mobile devices and other areas like that, rather than the pure Windows specific ones. So yeah, really a good move. Anything that adds better auth options to Active Directory, and specifically to Azure Active Directory, where everyone's moving, because just seems good to me, and bad for us red teamers.
Now, apparently Apple Watches have a walkie-talkie function. I didn't know that because I don't wear an Apple Watch, but a bug was found in it that was so bad that they nuked it while they fix it. Like, they just straight up disabled it. I mean, that must have been a pretty bad bug.
Yeah, so there's like a push to talk function where you can kind of hold your watch up and you pre-arranged with a contact to kind of use walkie-talkie style comms, and you push to talk on your phone, on your watch, sorry, goes out through your phone, there was some mechanism by which you could then abuse that to hot mic the phone or the watch through this thing, and Apple obviously being pretty sensitive to bad news about privacy and people being snooped on by their stuff, especially after that stupid bug with FaceTime video calling. They killed that functionality, or killed the walkie-talkie functionality whilst they're off fixing it, which I guess is a pretty good move. I mean, better that they do that than leave it vulnerable whilst they patch it. So yeah, I mean, good and bad.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's it. I mean, they're the ones who know the details there. So, I guess, I don't know. I kind of trust Apple to make good decisions on that stuff. Krebs has really gone back to his roots the last few weeks. Yeah. Just Krebs and so many people. This week, he Krebsed a bulletproof hoster. And what I love about this one, man, is there is a scan of the guy's passport.
Like, that's how you know you've got Krebsed, right? That's proper Krebs. When you wake up passport in the morning and your passport's right there on Krebs. On security.com.
Yeah, so he's looking at this bulletproof hosting provider and pulling the strings until out comes a passport scan.
Yeah, this guy's been running bulletproof hosting for quite a long time now, and it's definitely one of the bigger operators. Krebs has been working this guy for quite a while. And actually, he says that this is an investigation he did ages ago and then kind of came back to after being reminded of it. He went through, dug the guy's password out of some dumps that he got from wherever else, and makes a pretty compelling argument, in the usual Krebs style, tying together a bunch of historical domains and other business activities and things. Mr. Alexander Volosovic, probably not so happy today. And of course, the question you've got to ask with Krebs, Docs, and people like this is like, I hope he takes care, because you know, some of these people are, you know, have lots of money and, you know, having their stuff all go away, having their customer records burned, it's going to piss off, you know, some pretty nasty people. So,
yeah. Okay, so Adam, like as I mentioned in the intro, at this point of the show, we're going to bring Shubs in, Shubham Shah. He's going to join us in the news now to talk through all of this Zoom stuff. Shubs is, of course, the CTO at AssetNote, which is essentially a large-scale vulnerability scanning company. It sort of ties asset discovery to vuln scanning, so it can scan stuff you didn't even know you had. And full disclosure here, I am an advisor to AssetNote, and I do have a financial interest in the company. Shubs, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Pat.
All right. So this was a funny one, the way this came about, right? So I should probably explain that, like, you are still an active bug bounty participant while you're doing the AssetNote stuff. And around March this year, you wound up doing a bounty program that was commissioned by a third party to look at Zoom, right? Like, why don't you tell us how that unfolded?
Yeah, sure. So in March, we were invited to an event, and this is for a big company in San Francisco, a big startup. And as you know, all of these startups, they use Zoom day in, day out, and all of their employees basically have Zoom installed. So a part of this bug bounty program was to really take a deeper look at Zoom as well. For us, when we went to this competition, there was, you know, all these different scopes for this big company, but the one that really caught our attention was Zoom, because we always wanted to get a Zoom RCE.
Right. Any particular reason, or you just wanted to get a Zoom RCE?
Well, initially what it was I always thought that Zoom would be one of the best phishing vectors ever, because yeah. I always thought that, you know, you could send a link to anyone and it'd be a fake Zoom page. They'd go on it and they'd basically install anything to get that meeting working. And I know that that's been used very successfully in red teams. But I thought, you know what? What about Zoom itself? Like, what if we can get an RCE? And I saw a couple of blog posts that was, published by the team at Nessus around a bunch of bugs in Zoom that they found, but they didn't get to the stage of RCE. So I was like, surely there's something more. And that's when that's what really piqued my curiosity.
Yeah. Now, you actually began hunting for this one on the plane on the way to the event, firing up IDA for the first time ever. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. My friend had a license of IDA and a copy. So, you know, he lent me that. So I was taking a look at Zoom, and it's the first time I've used IDA. I'm very much so a web hacker. I don't really do reverse engineering day in, day out. I have dabbled in it and I've had to do it in different parts of my career, but it's not really something that I'm that proficient at. So when I was going through, I was often, you know, leaning over and asking Sean, which is our lead engineer, hey man, is this correct? Is this logic correct? Does this actually make sense? And we got to a block of code, which is essentially, you know, I think the smoking gun when we saw that, where it was like installing a package silently based on some user input. And I was just kind of shocked. I was like, is this actually happening? And Sean's like, yeah, man, I think you're onto something.
Now, this is funny, right? Because Jonathan Leitchu, who's the guy who wrote the blog post that went viral a week and a bit ago, you know, he found this auto join bug and then he wrote it up and he got so close to finding the RCE, right? So close. And this is why last week I'm on the show and because it is such a simple bug, I couldn't really spill it because there was still, you know, a fair bit of risk out there for people.
Yeah.
Now, Apple has squashed the vulnerable component, and just overnight they've actually squashed the white labeled Zooms as well, because they white label to other video conferencing companies and whatever. But I think we should probably explain the bug here, and strap yourselves in, folks, because it's a doozy. Shubs, what is the actual RCE bug in Zoom on Mac?
So it's actually quite simple, and Jonathan did do a really good job at documenting most of it in his blog post.
He has actually since figured it out and emailed me to let me know that he is kicking himself sufficiently hard, but do continue.
It is a really simple one, so I can totally understand that, but you can definitely miss it as well. I'm pretty sure we didn't get this one until halfway through the competition, and we were looking for a subdomain takeover frantically just as much.
Enough teasing. Come on.
Okay, no problem. It essentially looks for whether or not Zoom is already installed in your computer, and after it, if it's not installed, it then goes to check whether or not the parameters you've sent to the specific localhost endpoint at /launch equal to certain things. So it's looking at whether or not the parameter is equal to zoom.us, zipow.com, or zoomgov.com. Now, this is a direct equal to string, so it's looking at whether or not The input you've provided is directly equaling this.
So they're trying to peg you. You specify, as the client, you specify which version of Zoom it's supposed to get, and it has like a handful of hard-coded domains. It does a string match, right? So you're like, I need to use the government version of Zoom, so get it from here. So it checks those hard-coded domains, but...
But if these this initial match, if it doesn't match exactly, it then runs a different block of code, which is actually looking for whether or not it has the suffix of these words. So it doesn't matter if it exactly equals any of these domains, as long as it's the suffix, it will match. So that means, you know, you could have something like attackerdomain.com/.zoom.us/, and that would be accepted as a valid domain.
And then it just grabs a package from that URL and runs it.
Absolutely. And it installs it silently if it's signed. So it's ultra dangerous in that way.
Yeah. So that's the bug, everyone. Adam, did that feel good?
That felt good. Yeah. I wish I had the sad trombone button, because that would be an ample time to press it.
So, Now, one thing that I found particularly funny about all of this is, at the time that I recorded last week's show, I didn't know that it only affected people who'd removed Zoom from their computer, because it leaves behind that local web server, right? So to aid the reinstallation process. But the funny thing is, when Jonathan's blog post went viral, you know, a whole bunch of people would have been uninstalling Zoom, making themselves vulnerable to the RCE, which is, I'm guessing, why Apple squashed it through MRT, right? Like, I'm guessing they figured it out.
And I actually found it super interesting at how many white labels it affected as well. There's that huge list, and some of those companies are quite large as well. So I think the impact of this was much, much greater than we all anticipated it was.
Yeah, so it's Zoom, obviously, RingCentral, Telus Meetings, BT Cloud Phone Meetings, Office Suite HD Meeting, AT&T Video Meetings, BizConf, HuiHui, UMeeting, Zulu, and Zoom CN. And I think they found another RCE there as well. I don't know the details. One thing we should point out, though, is you guys, because it was not just you, it was the whole Asset Note team, you guys couldn't figure out how to trigger this if Zoom was actually present in the applications folder.
That's correct. And I don't think there is a way to trigger it when Zoom is actually installed. From everyone that I've been talking to who has recreated this bug, they've confirmed that they can only recreate it when Zoom is uninstalled.
Yeah. So... it's great, unless you've got users uninstalling en masse for some reason. So there you go, everybody. That was the bug. But Shubs, you're going to stick around for the next couple of stories, because this is kind of your wheelhouse. We've got a couple of criticals here in Atlassian products, one in Jira and one in Atlassian Crowd and Crowd Data Center. What can you tell us about these bugs?
This year has been there's been quite a lot of bugs that have been released for Atlassian products, and there's an uptick in server-side template injection. Earlier this year, we saw the Confluence RCE that was also a server-side template injection bug. And again, we're seeing this bug in Jira Server and Data Center, which is a server-side template injection bug that also leads to RCE. However, this one, it requires certain conditions in order to actually reach the RCE. So you need to have an SMTP server that has been configured within your Jira installation, and you also need to enable the settings to allow people to contact you via the contact administrators form. Now, both of these things, it's hard to say how many customers have actually enabled these, but it is very much so opt-in. If you have opted into this, then it means that any attacker, a remote unauthenticated attacker, can get command execution on your Jira installation. And really, as with everything with Atlassian products, update as soon as you can, because they do release these patches as soon as they can as well. And they've got a great advisory there. And the other thing I can recommend is subscribing to that and getting notified, because there are going to be more vulnerabilities in Jira Server and the other Atlassian products, I feel, coming. So it's best to subscribe and get them patched. Yeah,
it feels like they're having a bad year. I mean, Adam, you would probably use this sort of stuff in your red teams.
Yeah, we love these kinds of things. Any big organization that has a whole bunch of data, has a whole bunch of code lying around, Atlassian products, gets you right into the middle of where you want. This bug caused a lot of chortling around the office when we saw it, because you paste the code straight in the contact form, like that's just funny.
Yeah, it is. Now, what about this other one, Shubs, in Crowd and Crowd Data Center?
That one's also super interesting. And again, it's very critical. A completely unauthenticated attacker can get command execution on Crowd and Crowd data center. This is actually a CVE from May. It wasn't released this month, but the public proof of concept was released this month by someone named Corbin, who's also an avid bug bounty hunter. He wrote up a great blog about how to recreate the CVE, and it's actually super, super simple. It's very easy to exploit. And essentially, you can just point a jar file at a specific endpoint, and it will just take it and upload it. It feels like it's 2001 and you've got a shell. So it's quite a crazy exploit.
Good.
Yeah, it's a good one for sure.
All right, guys, thank you both very much for joining me to discuss the week's news, and Shubs for dishing that RCE, man, because like I'm glad it only took a week until it's safe to talk about. From my point of view, right, the reason I found out about this is because I was at TuskCon back in May. Your colleague Michael, Asset Notes CEO, he was at TuskCon, and he'd just come back from the event where they found the Zoom thing, and he was just talking about it over a beer. That's why when I saw Jonathan's post, I'm like, oh my God, this is the same thing, but he just didn't find the RCE. So that was my state of mind last week, just sitting there biting my tongue. But thank you both very much for joining us. And Adam, I'll chat to you next week.
Yeah, cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
Thanks, Pat.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau and Asset Note CTO Shubham Shah there. And Shubs tells me that Asset Note plan to have a blog post up about that Zoom bug. That should actually be out by the time I've finished editing this show. So look, as soon as it comes out, I'll drop a link in this week's show notes. And I will just mention also that Insomnia actually had a big job fall out of its schedule, Insomnia, where Adam works. So it actually has some availability over the next month. I know a lot of their clients listen, and they'll be very excited to hear that they have some availability because it is rare. So if you need your pens tested, do get in touch with Insomnia. It's time for this week's sponsor segment now, and this week's show is brought to you by Casada. Casada offers a very simple service. It's a proof-of-work-based bot filter, essentially, and it just works very well. Casada is an Australian startup that has gotten off to a terrific start by solving a very, very simple problem, that problem being bots, content scraping bots, credential stuffing bots, badly written bots that cause service disruptions. If it's a bad bot, by all reports, they do a good job of blocking it. Now, I'm sure they're using other methods, but the primary thing they've done here to make this thing work is to force clients to demonstrate some sort of proof of work before they can get anywhere on your service. And you'll see other websites that are maybe using some captures that do this. Other times you'll see things like Cloudflare hold you on one of its pages before you can proceed, just while it does that proof of work. But Casada's trick here is to do this invisibly so the user experience is unaffected. As I mentioned, it's a cloud service, and one of its customers is REA Group, and they are the operator of realestate.com.au. That's where you go when you're house hunting here in Australia. There's basically only two real estate sites. There's realestate.com.au and domain.com.au. And I'm pretty sure realestate.com.au is the bigger one. But anyway, Craig Templeton is REA Group's CISO and GM of Group Technology Platform. So he's basically the security guy and the platform guy. Now, REA Group was having some problems with bots. There were business concerns around content scraping. There were security concerns around cred stuffing and availability concerns around badly written bots causing service disruptions. And in the end, Craig picked Casada to solve that problem for REA Group. And he joined me for this interview to explain why. And he started off by explaining what was happening at REA Group before they found a good solution. Here's what he said.
We were getting a lot of lost engineering time, either through security incidents or just engineers getting woken up at 3 a.m. quite often and dealing with scrapers and stuff. But occasionally we do get service disruption as well because, like, let's face it, who says that people who write scrapers are any good at coding? So we get dodgy coding causing bad automation. We have a terms of service, who would have thought, that actually prohibits and really prefers people that they wouldn't scrape us. It does impact customer experience as well, not just from people trying to access your site. Maybe it starts getting a bit sluggish, but you potentially are getting web forms getting abused. So that then flows on to other people down the line. So I would say it was a range of issues that started really sort of bubbling up over time. So it got to the point where thinking, well, actually we need to start really seriously looking at this a bit more systemically. It also became apparent to us that there's quite a lot of other businesses that are feeding off our data. And I suppose the first thing to say here is that automation in of itself is not bad. It's simply that it needs to be on, we would prefer to be on our terms. So, but in order to do that, then we have to have some sort of protection so that we can...
You'd rather be licensing your data than letting someone just scrape it, right?
Absolutely, because that's sort of indiscriminate. We're not in control of that. And like I said, I would prefer to expose the data in a managed way rather than having somebody sort of indiscriminately pinching it.
It's funny what you said about service interruptions, because I know with, you know, any type of classified site, right? And realestate.com.au is essentially a classified site. You know, when you got that many listings and so many different ways to query it, I imagine that some of the people trying to scrape your data come up with all sorts of creative ways to run queries that can really slow things down, right? Because I know I've accidentally on classified sites before run a bit too much of a wildcard and I've watched the thing slow down, you know?
Yeah, we, you know, we leverage cloud computing quite heavily, and there's a cost to run that infrastructure. And even if you have auto scaling groups, you've got to set limits, right? And you got to manage and optimize around that. So it starts introducing quite a lot of interesting things, like in your log files, they just start filling up with crap. So therefore, how are you supposed to baseline what your normal state of play is whenever it's sort of polluted, let's say, with all this other nonsense? We've seen a range of everything from very simple sort of point and click bots to pretty sophisticated things which are literally pretending to be Googlebot. They're coming from an Amazon IP range. They're rotating maybe their user agent headers. They're rotating their IP addresses. So they're actually really determined to sort of come in low and be unnoticed. So we see everything.
Yeah, what is that? Just spoofed like agent strings and stuff?
Yep, all of that.
Yeah, I see that as well, man. Like, I think everybody sees that, but it's only a problem when, you know, I mean, you're running such a dynamic website that can actually cause quite a few burned cycles.
Well, the other thing is that there's actually a cost to this. So people think that, oh, well, stuff on the internet that's freely available is free, but it's not free. There's a cost to spin up this infrastructure. There's a cost of bandwidth. There's a cost of engineering time to run and maintain that. So it's like, you know, we were talking earlier about, imagine you're having a party and you invite 50 of your closest friends and you lay on all the food and drinks because you're a good host. You want them to have a good time. And then like 100 other people turn up and they start drinking your drink and eating your food, and you're a good host. So you go back and you go down to the shops and you get some more drink and some more food because, you know, you want to give your friends a good time and have a nice party. And then while you're away, another 200 people rock up and they eat your food and drink your drink. And then some of them take that food down to the park and start selling it. So now they're selling the food that you provided free for your friends. And then later on in the night, somebody comes along and another 100 people come along and they kick the door in and then they beat up your guests. And that's what we call credential stuffing.
That's what we call doing business on the internet,
yeah.
Essentially, right? Like, so look, you know, this is a sponsored interview from Casada. I mean, essentially, I'm going to boil down, and this is something I do quite frequently on the show, boil down what they do to really express it in its simplest form. And, you know, essentially what they make is a cloud-based anti-bot service that relies on proof of work to make a lot of these bots go away. I'm guessing that you started looking at solutions to this a while back. Like, what was the process that led you to eventually pick them? Because this is not something that is unique to Casada. There's plenty of anti-bot plays out there.
Yeah, there is, and there's various different approaches that people take. The first thing that the engineer started looking at was, well, we've got a web application firewall. We just start blocking them. Well, that lasted about 5 minutes because I did get this engineering team coming to me saying, yeah, we're getting hit quite aggressively by this fake Googlebot in Germany, and we're just going to block it. And I went, okay, come back to me on that. And after a week, they came back and they said, well, can you just make it go away? Because we're fed up getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning to deal with this. So it became evident to us pretty quickly that the WAFs were not going to be the answer to this. Even rate limiting, that only sort of limits what people can do. It doesn't still stop them from acquiring the data, so they just come in low and slow. So the other aspect was, we have login portals as well. So we're exposed to credential stuffing, and that seems to be the attack du jour at the moment. So like every man and their dog that has a login portal is just getting smashed by this. Yeah. Sort of, it got to the point where when you're facing something that is highly automated and highly dynamic, rules-based security just collapses. The dynamics of the game have now changed. So therefore, you need to fight automation with automation. And that's what sort of took us down the road to look at or companies like SATA.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the big things here, though, that is an advantage with Casada, though, is like the user experience. It's pretty much invisible to the user. I know there's other proof of work things like, you know, that company that also hosts Nazi forums, Cloudflare. They have one that at times you'll see like some sort of proof of work pop up in your browser before you land on the website you're heading to, which I'm guessing is probably not a direction you wanted to go in because it's kind of a crappy user experience. Is that right?
Yeah, and user experience is really everything these days. I mean, we've got Apple to thank for that. So the expectations are really, really high from a consumer point of view. Whenever people are designing products, they want to have as little friction as possible. They want seamless experience. They want a joined up experience as well. So increasingly, security is sort of falling back into that sort of transparent layer. And we really felt that Casada offered us that blend of good automated control and sort of seamless user experience. It just sort of sits behind and doesn't get in the way.
How does it actually deploy? Do you, you know, are they like a front end and everything routes through them, or is it some JavaScript you include in your application? Like what's the deployment look like?
Yeah, it's kind of like a reverse proxy. So we didn't really want to be deploying heaps of JavaScript and so on. So we simply route our traffic through Casada once they hit our CDN.
So it's CDN, then Casada, then you?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, right. So, and I'm guessing, you know, this is one of those projects where measuring the ROI is actually pretty easy, right? And that they're always the easiest ones to get approval for.
Actually, this is one of the few things I've actually ever been able to put a dollar metric on in terms of ROI. So that in and of itself was really good. The other thing was the speed of deployment was really, really quick. So you can be up and running in literally minutes. Really, really fast. I think the beauty is that they've actually nailed the onboarding process. When you're deploying security tech, the onboarding process can be pretty tricky. Like there's the POC and the demo that you've done, and once the sales guys leave, it's sort of like, okay, now we've got to plumb this thing in, and that's when the fun starts. But with Casada, it was the barrier to entry so low, it was really incredibly easy to get on. And once you actually start seeing those bots being blocked in real time, wanting to turn that off becomes really hard. Again, they've just sort of nailed the customer acquisition phase.
So where do they host? Are they running like their own stuff in AWS or something like that? Like, are you concerned at all by introducing some sort of, you know, latency or delay to queries because there's an extra hop, or has that not been an issue?
Yeah, so absolutely. They host in AWS. We're in AWS as well. There is an extra hop. That was a concern. So when we initially did the pilot, the engineering teams in the lines of business were quite concerned about this because, again, anything that would potentially introduce any kind of latency is frowned upon.
Well, and also a point of failure, and that'll be my next question, but latency first.
Yeah, so there was an extra hop. It was negligible. You know, it was less than 200 milliseconds. So when we did our performance metrics and so on, we looked at this and saw there's no discernible notice for a human. So that was fine.
Yeah. And in terms of availability, I mean, that would be another concern that people would have, right? Like, you are really trusting Casada not to have a bad time and take you down with them. Like, do you have contingencies put in place in case there are any issues, or you just or they have contingencies that you're satisfied with?
It's a bit of both. So we've done engineering on our side. We run two sites in two regions. So we're in Singapore and Sydney. We have hot failover as well. We can do some fancy stuff with routing. So if one, we do, like there's a heartbeat check, or we always constantly making sure that Casada's up. If it's within our tolerances, we're okay. And if it's not, we'll flip. So we've actually done some engineering on our side as well.
Craig Templeton, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Biz to be a case study customer for this week's sponsor, Casada. It's been very interesting, and I suspect there'll be a bunch of people working on similar platforms, online travel agencies, classified sites, job sites, all of those sort of sites that are dealing with this bot issue who will find that interesting. Thanks again.
Thanks, Pat.
That was Craig Templeton of REA Group there talking about Casada. If you are interested in blocking some bots, do head over to casada.io. That is casada.io. You can get some more info there. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I will be posting a Soapbox edition with Ryan Callumber from Proofpoint in the next couple of days. And that is a really good listen, that one. So do check it out. I don't say that about every Soapbox I post, but yes, that one is great. So do check it out. But yeah, until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.